It finally beats me up. This sleeplessness unwinds around your every word and every inch that's missing. And I still know how you breathe and how your music goes. The heaviness and focus in your kisses. Your last song, I swear, it's taking me apart. Piece by piece, I'm all laid out, forgive me. Your last song, I swear, I thought I could get through this. Quietly, now I can't speak at all. So much time's been wasted. We always walked alone.
Welcome, folks. My guest this episode is an artist who's been influencing our ears for a very long time, though some may not have been aware of it. These days, he is best known as the owner and operator of Oak House Recording Studio in Altadena, California. But back in 1998, David Peters was just a guy showing up to play the open mic at the coffee house I worked at. He and I hit it off, and a few years later, I was living at his studio in Hollywood, playing on his album, playing shows together around LA, and having him record what would become my record, notwithstanding. He has been an engineer, producer, or both, for so many albums by so many artists in my world, including four of my own records, that it's hard to keep track of them all. But he's always led a double life, and he is a critically acclaimed singer-songwriter in his own right. Having his own studio so many years ago gave him superpowers that really weren't available to other indie artists until very recently. He has always been able to record his creative ideas whenever he wants. He's always been free to update or even re-record and re-release new versions of existing work, and he's built a substantial cache of songs spanning his whole career that he can always pull from when he's choosing what to work on or release next. As long as I've known him, he's taken full advantage of these things. He was always making demo CDs and giving them to his inner circle, and not all those songs would make it to his officially released records. I have dozens of David Peters songs that never appeared on his distributed albums, and there are dozens and dozens more I've never heard. But there was one particular album he made that he only showed to a very small number of people. He made it in 1999, and he didn't let me hear it until the following year. To hear it is to understand why. It was only ever meant to be heard by one person. 21 short songs that flow like a private diary, raw and candid. He didn't care about what the world would think of them. He never expected the world would hear them. And so, of course, they're some of the most profoundly powerful songs I've ever heard. He called this collection the Secret Album. And for 18 years, it's been just that. It's been known only to a few people who know David and have even a shred of the album's context. The work that artists usually think is too personal to resonate widely is usually the stuff that does just that. And he is, finally, putting some of these songs out into the world. I would be remiss if I didn't help them along their way. So David and I took the opportunity to catch up over Skype and talk about his decision to revisit this very special music. Ladies and gentlemen, please enjoy more music from and these excerpts from my conversation with David Peters. When it originally came out, it was basically just like you vomited out your diary in song.
that sort of feeling.
Uh-huh. Where you just, that's exactly like what it was.
It's a really long love letter, unedited, just out there.
Yes.
Why all the editing now? Is it that you can look back at it so objectively that you're just picking highlights and saying, I don't want to revisit this, I want to revisit this? Or does it have nothing to do with that? Is it just this recording turned out better, this recording turned out better?
It's a little bit of a few things. This is something I was actually eager to pick your brain about, because I have two philosophies. Part of what I liked about the Secret album was that it was just a sprawling love letter, right? That's what it is. There's really lovely bits and creepy bits and weird bits, and it was rough and I'm out of tune, and that was part of the charm of what that was.
Okay.
So that was one side. I want to redo the entire thing and finally see it through. And the other side was, you know what? I have limited time and resources. I have two jobs, two children, a wife. This stuff takes time and money. I can't redo 21 songs when I also want to go back and redo other old records and things, right? So I have to make priorities.
This is what I mean about you are your own producer. A lot of artists don't have that ability to close the valve and put on the other hat and say, this will never happen.
I don't even know if I have the ability to properly do it, because I've spent way too much time just fussing around with these few little songs. The whole goal of the recording was to do it as fast as it was written. Even when I redid the songs, I'm like, I'm not going to get precious about this. I'm going to lay it down. When I started the process, it was super fast. Like, we started with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and I'm like, okay, drums, try this loop, try that loop. Nope, play this, play. Okay, no, that's the one, done, move. And it was like 15 minutes, let's go, next song. And we did some other songs that I finished that aren't on the album right now. But we just moved, and it was all just moving very, very fast. And then, of course, that just started to spiral out of control. And as I got to like the record more, I got more precious about it. And
sure,
then
like, but
hey,
I mean,
I'm getting kind of close. Now the vision I had in my head for 20 years, now let's see if I can actually create it. And so as I got deeper into each song and I realized what it was going to require, I just thought, I don't know if I can do all 21 songs. Plus, there are more things that aren't even in the original, you know. So I was like, am I really going to do all that? Or am I going to focus my resources and just get the ones that I like the best?
Good. You know? I don't think you should be apologetic about it. And most records, I don't mean other people's, I mean everyone's, mine, probably yours. Most records that I hear, in the back of my mind at some point think, this would be a really awesome 4-song EP.
Yeah. I think that about my favorite records of all time. Yeah, there's just too much, because it's not just music that's coming out today, but it's all of history of music, right? It just keeps adding up. Take the Beatles and I go back, and I'm not going to sit back and listen to every single thing. And
well,
they're all great.
They might be one of the exceptions, depending on the
album. They might be, right? They are. If anyone's the exception, it's going to be them. And I still will skip around or not listen to an album for a long time. And I think if I do that with the Beatles, I'm no Beatles. So what am I doing? Am I going to write? Am I going to sit and spend 2 years of my life and take time away from my kids and my work? And am I really going to like recreate 21 songs? And I just thought, I just can't make that equation work. I think the Secret album was one of those things where if you already knew what I did and you like to take in new music, I feel like those people liked the Secret album. But a lot of people that are just a little bit more casual about it just heard it and said, oh, this is wonky and weird. Put the other out back in.
I get it. Yeah. And I want to talk about that, because in a way it's kind of refreshing but brave that you did this.
I've been told so many times, so there's a few things that people tell me about my music. And one of them is, this is really good music to sleep to. And I don't know exactly how to take that.
What?
Then they always throw in, like, no, what I mean is, like, not that I need to be asleep during it, but, like, I like to fall asleep to this. Like, I like to sit down and get mellow to this. I'm thinking, uh-huh, yeah, you like to, like, it. This music is best enjoyed unconscious.
Unconscious.
Surprise, surprise, surprise. surprise. You're everywhere but where you were standing before.
Surprise is the other one that I really love. I think it's kind of its own little world. And that was really kind of summed up so much was happening at the time. You know, I just moved and relationships were ending and I found out things about family health. Just all these things were happening. And there were a lot of surprises. And although some of them were sad surprises, there were also a million other wonderful new things happening at the moment. And it was just that it was at one of those times in life where everything was in flux. And there was a real magic to that. I love kind of melancholy. I like that space. I probably like it because my life has been pretty good to me. So I like indulging in sadness because my sadness is pretty polite. I just like that space.
That's a good way of putting it. Okay. People who write all the happy songs are usually the heroin addicts.
Yeah, there you go.
Water me down. The threat of you fills so much space. My infinite rise has been leveled by the time I spend cleaning this place. Careful, a distance wore those old words out. One pass too deep and it all down.
So a few things were happening when I wrote what was the secret album. I had, you know, left a relationship to come out to California like most people do. That girl had just come out to visit and we thought, oh, I'm going to rekindle this. This is wonderful. I love this person. And then she went back home and then went on some trip for school and met her future husband and had just kind of called me with word. Hey, I met my future husband, right?
Yeah.
So we're over. And so part of me is like, oh, sad, we're over. But then I've been out here by myself for a year and I like California. So this is pretty cool. Like it was a very mixed bag, right? So I had that going on. I wanted to write without my normal, the pressures I was putting on myself. So I kind of hid out. But I was also making a record with my friends, Kate and David, and they were making a family record. It was the two of them and their 3 or 4 year old daughter. And that was a very loose process. So I was brought in to kind of organize everything, do the edits, do the mixes, and then they would come in. It was like I put paint in nice little piles and they would just come with their fingers and just smear it into like a big messy pile. And they're like, now it's interesting. I'm like, but now it's a mess. And then I would reform it into something and they would come and smear it again, right? But that really grew me in a different way. Like I said, oh, there's some real magic happening here. I'm a little too straight. I'm a little too square. They are very, very free, very messy, very colorful, very in the moment. But as we kind of meshed those two things, we started to get this kind of magical little record happening. And they were very good at championing other people. So they, when I came in, they had me not only doing the production, but I was singing a lot of background harmony vocals. So David, who had hired me, who I was there working for, he had started a little record label. He was trying to rewrite how the music industry worked. He liked the idea that everyone had their own little home studio and that you would pass music around home studios. He liked the idea of making records in basements. He had been roommates with rock stars and run magazines and running a label. He was very on this industry side, but from a very kind of creative end. His wife, Kate, was a big photographer for musicians, models, everything, right? She had been in an 80s pop band named Hazy Fantasy, who was really big in the UK, right? They were like a one or two hit wonder in the UK. And everyone in the UK from the 80s knows who they are. No one in America really knew much about them. So she was really in the world of fashion and show business and music. And she's just an artist at her core as well, right? So I have these two people as influences and they're telling me, oh, we love when you stack your voice and turn it into harmonies, we really like that. We just like this flavor. Please put it all over our little record. And we like you and your acoustic guitar. So that was a big push and influence. So as I'm hiding out in my basement from everybody and from the big studio, I didn't want the big studio there. I wanted to just have a little 4-track or an 8-track in front of me. I had my grandfather's old organ, which I didn't know how to play. but it had all these pre-programmed chords and beats and everything. And so I had them kind of saying harmonies, acoustic guitars, and all that kind of came together and created that mass writing spree that became the Secret album.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm living off memory and all the things I'm hoping come to be. Hope my distractions hold me happy. I dream of going out fighting all my might to step from room A into room B, and hopefully it shows. In these dry times the room caves in. I loved it when, though humbled, my wake-up wand was waving through. Like the moon, I will find my way high again. I'm just waiting, I'm stuck waiting through 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm calling these lonely girls.
One of the things that I wanted to talk to you about is your perspective on being a producer slash artist, which is still a very rare thing. It used to be that if you're a producer slash artist, that carried the weight of serious legitimacy because, wow, you're this polymath. And now everybody is a producer slash artist. But
I'm just way ahead of the curve.
Yeah, but
you know?
Nobody's really good at it. So even though everybody can call themselves that, it doesn't mean as much as it used to. You are still legitimately and seriously a producer slash artist.
You know, I got into recording and having a studio simply because I wanted to record my songs. That's the whole reason why I got started in the whole game. And then once I had the studio, then I could start making money recording my friends. And so to me, it's never been any other way besides doing both, because I got into recording simply because I wanted to make records in a certain way. And I didn't have the resources in a way to. There was nowhere to go. You know, where I grew up, there was nowhere to go to talk to somebody to do this stuff. There was nobody in my little town with a studio. So where would I go besides just doing it myself? And I loved the whole production side of it from the beginning. I think it was, I liked all kind of music when I was growing up, but I remember, you know, I grew up in the time of Bon Jovi, and I remember the Born to Be My Baby video came on MTV or something. I haven't seen it in like 30 years, right? So, but it came on and they're all hanging out in the studio making the song. I haven't even seen that. I should go watch that to make sure I'm even correct about what the video is. But I remember it's like, the vision I have in my head is that it's black and white and they're all in the studio together. I'm like, I want to be in that room. That's the room I want to be in.
So we can thank...
You can thank Bon Jovi and Born to Be My Baby for...
For the
everything
career of David Peters and everyone
forth.
You've touched.
And everyone I've touched. Thank you, Bon Jovi.
Getting back to the whole thing about how it's like reading somebody's diary, the poignancy of the Secret album is the awkwardly candid view you get of the emotions that created it.
Of this person in the moment. And what we were talking about a moment ago, like why did you pare it down into 8 or 9 songs, and why? And I talked about, yeah, my time and kids. My big question was, is the power of whatever this might be. I have an art project. It's been in my head and my heart for a long time, and I really want to do it. But is it special because there are some nice songs on it that I should redo? Or is it special because of what it was? Is it special because it's 21 sprawling, candid little pieces? And that it's not about that there's like, oh, there's a couple songs people might like on it, I should redo those. Or is the whole point of the record the fact that it's 21 candid, rough things?
I would say the answer is yes. They're vignettes. Sure, the songs from a larger work can become popular even though you don't have the context of the larger work, because there's always a bit of the intention embodied in the vignette of the smaller work. And I think that's completely true with the songs you've selected to put out in... What are we calling this again?
So the title is going to be Makeshift Memorials.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, that's what they are.
And they are. And I think they embody the intention of the larger work. And what would be so bad if anybody listened to these 8 pieces and then said, all right, I need to hear the original.
You want to hear the actual thing.
Yeah. Yeah,
the actual album. Yeah.
People clamoring outside your house for the secret album, chanting.
Yes. Can't wait for that day. Yeah.
Yeah, we had a great time. As usual, to hear the rest of the interview, as well as the full versions of all the songs featured, patrons can download part 2 of this podcast from my Patreon page. Becoming a patron for $1 gives you access to part 2 of this and every podcast I've put out, as well as the new music I release just about every month. Get in on that at patreon.com/SethHaran, and we'll see you after the jump. To close out, here's one of many Seth songs that David produced. This is Panic Attack.
Just protect me from myself. I said it's under control.